The gas bottle's not for respiration, it seems. I spin around just in case, but it shows no sign of coming back. Instead, is that a rip on the wall opposite? Whoops. Yes, it is. The little burglar just punched a hole in the outer membrane of the town. The crew won't be happy about that, I figure. Better get out of here. I scramble down the ladder, and carrying all my dead sister's soul chips in a shoulder bag, I go in search of whatever deal Victor has lined up for me. Telemus and Lindy. Victor's dive is barely busier than it was before I vamoosed. But there's a stranger sitting in with Victor, and Milton nods me over as I step in the door. "Ah, Freya," says Victor. "I'd like you to meet Ichiban." Ichiban, number one, I translate, turns blue porcelain eyes the size of dinner plates on me and bows his head very slightly. I nearly take a step back as a reflex yells, "Aristo!" at me. But then I realize, no, he wants to look like an Aristo. But he isn't one. Never can be. "I'm very pleased to meet you," I say, bowing back at him. Mindless courtesies ensue as I try to get a handle on what he is. "Ichiban has a minor problem that you might be able to help him resolve," Victor explains. "It involves travel." "I'd be very happy to offer any advice I can," I agree cautiously. "Yes," Ichiban nods thoughtfully. "You are very big." He looks up at me. It's true. I'm almost 170 centimeters tall. An idealized replica of our creator's kind, in fact, unlike the super-deformed midgets who are the commonest phenotype of the nouveau riche these days. "Good thermal inertia," adds Ichiban, unexpectedly. "And you were designed for Earth, before the emancipation." "Good thermal inertia?" I smile as my biomimetic reflexes cut in, my cheeks flush delicately, signaling mild embarrassment or confusion. "Emancipation? What's he talking about?" "I'm afraid I don't quite follow," I say. "My sponsors have an object that requires transportation from the inner system to Mars," Ichiban says, then pauses delicately. "So why talk to me, I wonder? Travel isn't my strong point. It's too expensive for those of my lineage to indulge in frequently. When you double the dimensions, you multiply the volume by 8, and hence the mass and the energy budget required to make orbit. I'm twice as tall as the next person. That's largely why I'm stuck here, and the solar system's a playground for chibi dwarfs instead of real people." I summon up a mask of polite attentiveness to conceal my disappointment. "It is currently being prepared on Mercury and needs to depart in approximately 80 days. Our problem is that the object is a delicate research item of considerable value. It requires supervision and must be maintained in a shock-proof environment under conditions of constant temperature, pressure, and oxygenation." He continues to stare at me. "I believe others of your type have on occasion worked as escorts or couriers, yes?" Where did he get that from? I boggle briefly. "My archetype was indeed designed as an escort," I say cautiously. "Escort for what?" I leave unsaid, just in case. Certain prejudices die hard. "As an escort for organisms of a strictly biological variety." Ichiban agrees, nodding amiably. "Pink goo replicators." I try to hide my shock. "What exactly is this research artifact?" I ask. "I'm not able to tell you that." Ichiban is still smiling faintly. The details have been withheld from me for reasons of commercial confidentiality. However, I am authorized to pay for your immediate steerage passage to Cinnabar, if you will agree to meet with my colleagues and to consider their assignment. He raises a warning finger. You are not the only contractor we're approaching. This is a task of some delicacy. Our competitors would be delighted to disrupt this project, so there's no guarantee that you will be chosen. But I understand you require off-world transportation in any event, so it is my hope that we may help each other. They want me to transport a biological sample? A living one? I almost reel with shock. I would be delighted to help, I stutter on automatic. But in steerage? Ichiban's smile fades slightly. It will cost us dearly to put those big limbs of yours in orbit, he warns. Which is to say, don't push your luck. I nod, resigning myself to the inevitable. A walkabout berth would be too much to hope for. When do you want me to leave? Ichiban glances at Victor. Immediately, he says. You will come with me now. And the interview's over. Ichiban hustles me out a back alley I didn't know about and up a steep companionway to a road where there's a waiting rickshaw, drawn by a pair of pony boys who give me a wall-eyed glare when I get in. It creaks under my weight, but Ichiban seems unconcerned. Fly, he tells the pony boys, and they're off at a trot, tails held high. I notice a couple of small ornithopters tracking us. Are they yours? I ask. Ichiban gives me a bland look. Leave them to me. He leans back in the seat and closes his eyes. A few seconds later, one of the bird bots begins to smoke and veers wildly off course. The other gives us a more cautious berth. We turn down a side passage and draw up outside a spacious boat bay, where a tiny gondola is waiting beneath a semi-inflated gas bag on the other side of the airlock. What's this? I ask. Best to get you out of town as fast as possible. Get in. Ichiban gestures at the gondola. It's got power and feedstock. Make yourself comfortable. It's going to be your home for a while. I examine the thing doubtfully. It's a snug cocoon of struts and wispy padding, sitting atop a cylindrical power and feedstock adapter, with some kind of grapple under the seat. I probably outweigh it 3-1. You expect me to wear that all the way to Mercury? Yes, he smiles blandly. Your lift arrives in just over an hour. I stop with one leg already half inside the cocoon. You've bought me a lift ride? I can't help it. I end on a whine. Of course. It's Ichiban's turn to look slightly bemused. How else did you expect to reach orbit this Dian? I sit down gingerly and slide my other leg into the cocoon. It's beginning to sink in. Take it, my memories urge, and I cave. My gas exchange system is too well designed to surge, but were I of my true love's species, there would be damp palms and thudding heartbeats in profusion. I don't know what I expected. A leisurely jet ride to one of the equatorial stations, perhaps, then a slot in a scheduled launch. But we're near the North Polar Plateau, and that would take time. Ichiban's backers have bought time on an orbital pinwheel, and even now it is cranking its 1,000-kilometer-long arm into position, ready to dip down into the stratosphere and grab me like a floating blossom on the breeze. I lie down and let the cocoon suck me in. This has got to be costing them thousands, I realize. More than an aristocrat's berth. How do I talk to... Your cocoon will tell you everything you need to know, says Ichiban, turning away. The glittering tattoos on his shoulders and arms wink at me as he walks off.
Hello!
The cocoon squeaks breathlessly.
I'm Lindy. Thank you for choosing to travel with my owners, Astrodyne Tours. What's your name?
Source code preserve me. She sounds enthusiastic. As if I need that. I'm Freya, I admit. Are you...
Hello, Freya. I'll be your spaceship for today. Are you comfortable? Feeling tense? I know how to deal with that. Let me give you a massage. I hope you don't mind, but I see you're a classic design. Do you have any cavities? Ooh, a gas exchange lung. I'd better pack it well. I need to install a few probes. Don't worry, I'll make it feel good.
Lindy chatters away breathlessly as her probes nuzzle and squeeze into my orifices, filling my intimate spaces front and rear, top and bottom. It's not the intromission that offends. She's considerate and lubricious. The pulsing sense of congestion pleasant after so long without intimate contact. But I find her personality annoying. It's like being molested by a sleeping bag that speaks in Comic Sans with little love hearts over the eyes.
Ooh, that's a big colon you've got. Does it go anywhere? It's a long time since I've been inside one of these. Here, I'll just hook your visuals up and you'll be snug inside me. How's that?
A brief lurch and I can see out again. She's hooked my eyes and ears and output line up to her sensorium, and now I can see that I'm lying on the deck, cocooned inside her white tube as she squeezes slippery packing foam into all my internal spaces. It's a good thing I'm not claustrophobic. I lie back and stare up at the underside of Lindy's balloon. I wonder what my true love's kind would have made of this means of transport. Probably most of them would have fled screaming at the impersonal sense of violation. But a few... When do we launch? I ask, trying to ignore the warmth filling me.
Any moment now,
Lindy says brightly, then squeezes my nipples affectionately.
Relax and let me help you enjoy the ride.
I shudder as the balloon lifts free of the deck. My cocoon is paying rather more attention to certain bits of my anatomy than is strictly businesslike. It's been a long time since anyone took that kind of interest in me. Lindy, do you make love to all your passengers? I ask.
Only the ones who are equipped for it, she chirps, throbbing inside me. It helps them pass the time. Ooh, I see we're in for a ride on Telemus. That'll be fun. I like him. He's cute.
I groan silently. My mouth is agape, constrained by the soft spacer that holds my lips and throat open, and feel the unscratched itch building up inside me. I can't help myself. Some reflexes are built into my lineage too deeply to control consciously, and it has been a very long time, too long, since anyone made love to me. Even a not-very-bright surface-to-orbit sleeping bag. I writhe, or try to, Lindy has me thoroughly immobilized, and just as I'm about to ask her to back off on the customer care front, she squirms again.
Oh, oh, yes, yes, oh!
One of the peculiarities of my lineage is that although we superficially resemble a female of our creator's kind, we differ profoundly in some ways, especially our sexual reflexes. In our default state, unless we're unconditionally imprinted on our one true love, when someone becomes aroused over one of us, we become aroused over them. This is conditioned into us at a very low level, with the aid of some low-level modification to our basic neural architecture, and the addition of something called an enhanced vomeronasal loop reflex. Without that reflexive arousal, I'd be useless for my design purpose, but it sometimes has annoying side effects. And so I lose most of 3 minutes to a very overdue orgasm, and the afterglow keeps me preoccupied for another hour. This is probably a good thing, because if I were left alone to contemplate my predicament, helpless and hog-tied inside a launch cocoon floating through the sulfuric acid clouds of Venus with only a soap-bubble-thin gas bag between me and the red-hot foothills below, waiting to be yanked violently into low orbit by a 1,000-kilometer-long cable, I might be close to panic. Especially as a malign aristo wishes me ill, and strangers have turned over my pad all in the past 6 hours. And then there's the upcoming lift ride. But Lindy knows exactly how to distract nervous passengers, and I suspect assigning one of her kind to keep me quiet was part of Ichiban's plan all along. I've ridden in lift pods before. It's the easiest way off Earth. But leaving Earth was different. That time I was already in hibernation, packed in a commercial wide-body load, and hiked up to speed on a hypersonic sled before docking. This is a solo ride on a Big Dipper, with an arm 1,000 kilometers long, the tip counter-rotating along its orbital path, dipping down until it's just 50 kilometers above mean ground level in order to yank me up to orbital velocity in half a rotation. I'm going to be pulling tens of Gs, which is partly why Lindy has been so enthusiastically stuffing me. I need the padding. "What happens once we reach orbit?" I ask her, trying not to dwell on the process. "Who cares?" she says dreamily. "Telemus is wild. I haven't ridden him in ages." I'd grind my teeth if she hadn't carefully gagged me. "Well, my template has, but this is all new to me. This is my first flight. Oh, I'm so excited!" She shivers slightly, and I feel the tremors running through her skin. "My flight itinerary," I say carefully. "It matters to me."
"We'll get you there," she giggles briefly. "Telemus will drop us just in time to catch the high wire, and he'll take us the rest of the way. It'll be fun."
"You're going the whole way?" I ask, trying to conceal my dismay.
"Yes! Once Highwire has us, I'll morph into my second instar to keep you snug and safe from all the nasty radiation and micrometeoroids."
She simpers as she flashes up a schematic of her type second instar, a form with stubby solar wings, a heat exchanger, and a mirrored parasol. They form a fetching ensemble for a cocoon hanging off a bow of the great ship Highwire, or one of his sibs.
"We'll have lots of time to get to know each other. Whee!"
I'm still searching for a suitably withering retort when I glimpse the arm of Telemus tracing a white scar down through the beaten bronze dome of the sky toward us. And then I do have second thoughts. But by then it's too late. Lindy has obviously been looking forward to sex with Telemus for ages, if not her entire life, and he reciprocates. They fuck hard and fast at too many Gs, his docking hectocotylus locked tight inside her launch adapter. I find the comm setting to screen out their groans and shuddering endearments before I get caught up in it. I lie alone and slimy in Lindy's abdomen, squished down by the centripetal acceleration as Telemus yanks us into orbit. I have a lot of time to think black thoughts. It's not that I mind that my steerage cocoon is a slut, but if I don't get some decent conversation en route, I'll go mad before we arrive. I should have plugged in the graveyard before we left, I realize. At least the ghosts of my sisters would keep me well grounded. But it's too late now, and I'm not going to ask Lindy to hook me up. Some things are too private. The thundering pressure of the ride falls away from me, and I cut back into the open chat channel in time to hear Lindy whisper tearful goodbyes to her beau. I open my eyes and see Telemus in all his glory, dropping back toward the pearlescent cloud tops, tentacle tip retracting into its maintenance shell.
Goodbye, Lindy calls. I love you.
Until the next you, rumbles Telemus, his voice dopplering away as we rise above him. I try to get the star-crossed lover's attention as we drift away. Lindy, can you see Highwire yet? After a brief pause,
yes! He's over there!
A blinking red ring flashes around a barely visible speck of starlight.
Isn't it exciting?
She gives me a brief squeeze. I close my eyes. Patience. I don't like travel much, I say, the most tactful lie that comes rapidly to mind. Can you put me into full hibernation until we arrive?
Are you sure?
She sounds doubtful, as if the mere idea of anyone not enjoying drifting helplessly between the stars with only a vacuous tart for company is incomprehensible to her. I'm sure, Lindy, I pause. Do you have any alternative personality modules? I add plaintively.
Sorry,
she says brightly.
I'm me. We're all me. With the Mod 42 short-duration environmental support capsule, what you see is exactly what you get. And I want you to know I really love having you inside me. But if you're sure you want to sleep...
I am, I say firmly, and close my eyes, hoping that it'll be dream-free.
Oh, all right. Sleep tight.
The universe goes away. The dirty truth, a truth universally acknowledged today, but bizarrely never admitted by any of my true love's kind, is that space travel is shit. I use shit as a generic placeholder for a vile and unpleasant substance with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. Being instantiated as and when I was, I have no direct experience of scat. We had to practice with diatomaceous earth and brown dye. But I digress. If you're rich, you can rent a stateroom in the supercargo spaces of a big strange person with a mag sail or a nuclear electric drive, depending on what direction you want to go in. And you, and a few 16s of other folk, get to socialize and intrigue and backstab and be bored together for weeks or months or years on end, in a space not much larger than my rented rack in a cloud city afloat over Venus. Bandwidth is expensive and metered. Someone must keep a relay antenna pointed at your host's brain and feed it with kilowatts just to support your idle chatter. And the stars and planets move so very slowly. But it's much worse if you're poor. If you're poor, they wrap you in a stupid cocoon and strap you to the outside of the ship. It's cold or hot, and the radiation burn keeps your marrow technae churning with the demands of self-repair. And if you're unlucky, a sand grain with the energy of a guided missile blows you limb from limb. If not for the stimulating company of your cocoon and any other steerage passengers you can talk to, you go insane from sensory deprivation. You can opt for slow time, but that's got problems of its own. Or you can go into total shutdown hibernation, and possibly die in transit and never wake up again. And that's it. It lasts for months, or even years. You want to know what it's like to emigrate to Saturn's system? Imagine spending 6 years in a straitjacket tied to the outside of a skyscraper, with only a couple dozen similar lunatics for company. Even with slow time, it's going to feel like months. You're wearing a blindfold, which is probably appropriate because every couple of days, just to break the monotony, a not very accurate cosmic sniper fires a random shot at the building. And you wonder why my sisters don't get out much? Of course, that's nothing compared to interstellar travel, where they freeze you and chop off your limbs to save weight and grow you new ones at the other end if you arrive sufficiently intact after decades and centuries in the vasty deep. but I'm not planning on going to Pluto or Eris or Kuwar to seek passage on one of the starships. At least not just yet. My one true love species used to dream about space travel. It's ironic. They were so badly designed for it that a couple of minutes' exposure to vacuum would have killed them irreversibly. To go up and beyond Earth's atmosphere required elaborate preparations, a complex portable biosphere. Journeys of any duration necessitated cumbersome and heavy radiation shielding. And that's before you consider all the other drawbacks. When they first developed the organs of exploration, there was no there. So they built timid, stupid machines and hurled them into the airless void to report back. Then they built idiot phone exchanges and put them in orbit to fill the void with chatter. Obsessed with biological replicators, they ignored the most interesting corners of the solar system and focused on dull, arid Mars. They periodically scurried up above the atmosphere and hunkered down in tunnels on Luna or ventured on expedition to domes on Mars, and they died in significant numbers before the end, simply because canned primates couldn't thrive in vacuum or survive solar flares. Late in the day, when there weren't enough of them left, they sent people like me, intelligent servants, to run the domed bases and camps and to conduct their research by proxy, and finally to build cities that they would never walk the streets of. Some of the people they sent were orthodox in body plan, but most were designed for vacuum and high radiation environments and corrosive cloudscapes and microgravity. We, slaved in mining camps and died in launch accidents, and built places where my true love's kind could live, made somewhere out of nowhere. But one day, they weren't there anymore. Dead. They were all dead. What killed them, I can't say. Rhea, template matriarch and prototype of my kind, might have been able to tell us, for she lived among them in their twilight decades. But she died before I was instantiated, leaving only stale regrets to we final few who came into being too late to know true love. Before our dead creators built my kind, space was empty as far as telescopes can see, and desolate with it. But we filled the void, and now there are places to go. Circumsolar space has been settled. Starships are en route toward the nearer extrasolar worlds, crewed by the brave and the foolhardy. The colonies are barbarous and lawless compared to the huge cities of Earth. Playgrounds for jaded aristos, where fortunes are made and lost, and empires built and demolished against the breathtaking beauty of sterile planets and moons. And at last, we're not alone among the stars. But space travel is still shit. It's expensive and unpleasant, and it takes you a long way from your friends. But not, unfortunately, your enemies. Of course, I don't hibernate for the entire voyage. That would be foolish, and possibly fatal. And although I am unconvinced that I desire life, I'm not yet ready to embrace death. I wake briefly as Lindy happily chatters her hellos to the laconic high wire, and I force myself to stay awake as the spaceship's tether grabs her and she crawls hubward and settles down on the spaceship's load-bearing truss. I sleep again after she bites into the feed lines and power circuit and starts to metamorphose around me. A boring interlude, as her brain undergoes considerable rearrangement at this time. And then I wake again as we near our destination. Highwire cycles permanently between Mercury and Venus on an elliptical transfer orbit, taking half a year on each trip. He never enters planetary orbit, but uses his powerful tether, a smaller sib to Telemus, to catch incoming travellers and launch departing ones. Lobbing us up to him, or catching us at the other end, is the job of the local tethers or maglev trucks at the destination planet. Unlike many ships, especially in the outer reaches, Highwire works alone, without a crew of auxiliaries. But he's not lonely. He gets to talk to a lot of travellers,
In fact, it's almost a rite of passage. So I spend a good 3 days hanging upside down from a structural truss covered in cargo pods, the sunlight casting acid-sharp shadows in front of me, giving him an abbreviated life dump.
"So you left your home because you wanted to segment yourself from your sibs,"
Highwire rumbles thoughtfully. He pitches his voice low, adopting the gravitas due his station.
"But are you fond of them? Why did you do that?"
"They were dying too fast." I hug the graveyard of memories inside Lindy's silent chrysalis. I couldn't stand to think I'd be just another.
"But they're all older than you, subjectively. Your 61-year gap."
"What, 6 decades? I'd shrug if I could. We developed differently, of course, but we all had the same problem. The yawning hole in the center of our badly designed lives. How can you love yourself if you can't love somebody else?"
"Many people do not find that a problem," Highwire muses. "They exist adequately without loving anything, themselves included."
"Yes, but that's not the point. You're happy. You're doing exactly what you were designed to do. But imagine somebody invented teleportation and made you obsolete overnight. What would you do then?" Without missing a beat, Highwire replies,
"Without a job, I think I would head for the stars, to see what's out there."
He's obviously been thinking about that question a lot. "But why would anyone want to go off Earth?" "I did. Once. I had a lot to run away from. Too many bad memories, too many sibs gone before me into the beyond. I'm one of the last, instantiated after we were already obsolete, frozen for over 60 years at one point, running far beyond my design. Over the past century, the exigencies of space travel have driven body fashion in a direction I can't follow. Designed as companion for my one true love, deceased, my sense of identity is strongly bound to my physical shape. I can't easily remodel myself as a Chibi-san, small, wide-eyed, and big-headed, because it would deny my whole purpose, lovely and obsolete. Without even that tenuous raison d'etre, I might as well die. And so, demoted from goddess to ogress with close-set, tiny eyes, I chose to flee. We all make mistakes, don't we? All good times come to an end, and bad times too. Boring ones just taper out.